weaves that individually into the wall of the cocoon. And then I guess it's essentially photosynthetic. During the period that the caterpillar is turning into a pupa inside, and then maybe over even a course of the winter. So I thought this was great, and I just thought I would put this together in a little short communication. And so I had the larva, which was really outstanding, the cocoon, which was even more exceptional, and a small moth. So I sent it to John Brown sort of for an internal review, and he said that was really great, but it wasn't enough. So he actually wanted a full species description. He thought, and it was for good reason, this is the first time any hypanodine in the New World had ever been looked at. And so it made sense. I didn't like it, though, because it was such a small larva, and I only had this one individual. So what I did, when I do all of these kinds of things, I'm completely outgunned and outmatched by John Rollins and Tim McCabe, who actually know way more about all this. So I asked both of them if they could help me out, if they were familiar with these creatures. And Tim McCabe came on board. He had reared a number of creatures, not actually this one, but a related species, Brimleana, which I'm about to show you. It has a very checkered taxonomic history. I guess that's one of the take-home messages from my study. I guess this Abobloma, this creature, had been moved from the Acantianae to the Hypodonidae to the Strepismanini to very recently, actually, just in 2005, Fibiger described a new nocturid subfamily, the Areopterinini. I hate it when I can't even pronounce the names of the organisms I study, but in any case, Fibiger and LaFontaine had recently moved this creature into yet another subfamily. So this is it. It's a striking creature. It has missing pro legs on both A3 and A4, which is very exceptional. These hypertrophied setae that, again, would extend way off the screen, off to the left. It has a papillated integument, more so than anything that I've seen in the 800 so species that I've looked at. Enormous populations that are actually visible maybe to people in the back of the room, but certainly when a caterpillar is in hand. And it's kind of remarkable here that the even the fifth pro leg is reduced, and then it's shifted clear back to the back of the segment, and then the pro leg on the following segment is shifted forward, so they essentially work together. What we're making here is analogous to a geometrid. They're essentially losing those mid-abdominal pro legs. McCabe also mentioned during the course of the study, once he came on board, that there was another noctua that had almost identical male genitalia called Megidia formosalis. And he said that we really ought to look at that. So, of course, he also had larvae. And it was just remarkable to me to find out how many putative synapomorphies we found between the two insects. They both had the same very unusual pro-leg arrangement. Segments, the first four abdominal segments were elongated. And so it goes as you go down this thing. The D1 CD are pointed forward, but the D2 CD are pointed backwards. And I guess what is really important here, though, is that one of these was in the Areopterinae, and one of these was in the Scalica campinae, and that just couldn't be. Two other characters that are shared, and I won't be able to share this, but it's important, is the venter, both of those caterpillars, is jet black, very, very much contrasting with their cryptic coloration here. And probably the most remarkable feature of these caterpillars is that most noctuids, in fact, most noctuids, have six stomata on the side of the head. That's how you can tell a caterpillar from, say, a hymenopteran or coleopteran. But these are usually in a hemispherical arc, and in both Abobloma and Megidia, the stomata are split into two groups. Four of these are split off up towards the L-ceta, and two remain their ancestral position near the antenna. So it turns out that Abobloma and Megidia, I would be surprised if they didn't have an immediate common ancestor, but they share perhaps as many as a dozen putative synapomorphies. We wanted to look more widely and just look at what was going on in these very basal noctuids. And it turned out, and I don't really know why, but Abobloma shares remarkable similarities also with the type of the Hypanodini, and it also shares a lot of very special features with the Euboemini. Just to go through one example again, This would be the type of yet another subfamily. The segments here are elongated. We've got the same arrangement of the prolegs here with the A5 shifted backwards and A6 shifted forward. Even more remarkably, it also, as far as I'm concerned, this is a globally unique synapomorphy, this idea that they build these pendant cocoons oftentimes out of lichen fragments. So this is shared between Aboblema and the Hypanodini. So the take-home message for me at this point is that we need a Tree of Life people or some other people to take a hard look at the higher classification of these lower noctuids. I think things have been oversplit to a very large measure, and we need more immatures and some molecular data to look at this. You always get these interesting spin-offs or things that come out of your work that you're never expecting, so I thank John Bound for this. We would never got this far. Bark rusters include Aboblema. They are typically cryptic, doors eventually compressed, so they can sort of be bark. And they oftentimes have these laterally extended portions of their body, and they're elaborated. They could be seedy or lappets or rootlet seedy. Just to show you an example, this is Lasiocampid, Talipe velida. These are the lappets that lappet moths have, and they have these hairs that shoot off laterally. Help them do this. So there is a caterpillar there. But the interesting thing that came out of our study, and I think we're the first to report this, is that these bark rusters actually have flash coloration. Unfortunately, I can't show you this in Aboblema. The lower left is Aboblema, but again, it has jet black, and when this thing flips over, it jumps out at you. But I do have the ventures of these other creatures, and I found a new good use for a flatbed scanner. Spectacular flash coloration, I think, and you'd never ever know or appreciate this, but these things, when they get flipped off a log or something like this, would probably jump out, and these must function analogously to the hind wings of a catocala, or maybe even the blue flash of a morpho wing. But as soon as they roll over, the search image is gone. When we were beating for Aboblema, we also got geometrids that had never been reared before from lichens, and archaeids had never been reared before from lichens, Lophosiae. So we got interested in this whole idea of lichen feeding and algal feeding, and did a review where Tim McCabe and I have reared about 38 species of macrolepidopterans from algae or lichens. Right now our set for North America includes members of Archaeidae, Geometridae, and Noctuidae, and actually 8 different noctuid subfamilies, but they're oversplit, so that doesn't matter. And then there's 34 to 38 is that we've reared on Protococcus algae, and so this includes Lophosiae and Archaeids, which are generally thought to be or regarded as lichen feeders. And our data, or at least from our rearings, these range from extreme algal specialists, such as the one shown here, Clementia albata, to some really widely prolificous things. They do eat algae and lichens, but I think they eat cardboard. I haven't tried it. But the most important point from this is that algae and not lichen appears to have primacy in the diet. So it's a bit of a misnomer, a mischaracterization in our current literature as to what these organisms are doing. We were able to rear them all successfully on algae. We were not able to rear any successfully only on lichens, unless there was algae associated with that lichen, and often that lichen had to be wetted to make sure that that protococcus was growing. So then we submitted the paper and we thought we were good to go, but then Don LaFontaine wanted us to do more. And so he sent it back and said, please say something about the evolution of algal feeding and lichen feeding. So at this point, we've identified at least 3 different origins within the Lycaena butterflies. There's a South African group, Anemone geometrids, and then if the noctuids have many multiple cases, certainly in the Nolids, Archaeids, a couple lineages, and then if we expand this out, about 5 different subfamilies in the quadruped noctuids and one subfamily in the trifid noctuids. In summary, from what we've seen so far, we can say that there are multiple origins among macrolepidopterans. There are many, many origins, at least a dozen I would guess, but there's only 2 large clades. There's the Lophosiine Archaeids and the Leptinine Lycaenids in South Africa. And it's funny that the only 2 large clades are brightly colored. And conversely, all the smaller radiations have cryptic and often lichen-colored adults. And a polyphagy commonly appears as an evolutionary antecedent to lichen feeding lineages. And so I don't really have a summary. I do have more questions or research agendas. And so we really feel that the classification for the basal nocturnes has been oversplit, and we could use some more data and more taxon sampling there. I don't know why the two largest clades of lichen feeders are also brightly colored. And so we need to explore the role of lichens in the diet and the importance of sequestration in the chemical ecology of these insects.
Thank you.
This is me up there and with a hat on. This is from product of my lab and a bunch of other people. I mean, there's John Harrod, myself, James Monroe, David Hawks, and Aisha Furkan is here. And I want to mention there's many, many others that have contributed to this over the year. We have a growing analysis, and this is part of the Tree of Life project. And the whole issue of the unfolding of relationships is really just, I want to sort of get across some things that we've been finding with secondary structure and how that might, you know, impact the way some of you are looking at your own data sets. And again, I want to make it clear that chalcedoids are not Lepidoptera. We do kill all of your Lepidoptera. We don't touch the adults, but, you know, eggs, larvae, you don't get adults because of us. This is a wasp. You know, this is what most people think of a wasp. This is also a wasp, which most people don't really understand how small wasps can get, and that's, of course, not the smallest wasp by the ear there. These, of course, the megalith, you know, eucaridid wasps that love to kill ants and things like that. But generally, we're dealing with very small things. Chalcedoids have a tremendous morphological diversity, but one of the things you have to understand is they're also all very extremely small. We're generally averaging in size about 2 millimeters, but we're going down to it from a tenth of a millimeter all the way up to a gigantic 45 millimeters, but that's a real rare case. But they have a tremendous amount of form and diversity of things, and they also do a million things, too. So basically, you can say that chalcedoids are attacking everything in some different way. We have a few plant-feeding groups, but generally they're attacking virtually every life stage of any group of organisms. Okay, the rundown is basically we're dealing with a group that has 19 families, more than 80 subfamilies, and I think some of the biggest taxonomic changes we're going to come up with out of the Tree of Life is going to be basically making this the Diptera of the Hymenoptera world, where we can take acalypterates and just like blow them up all over the place with a bunch of new families, because that's what it's leading towards. We've got more than 2,000 genera and 22,000 described species. However, as John